You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Kevin Birmingham, author of the most dangerous book, The Battle for James Joyce Ulysses, which is his debut. It was published this June in time for Bloomsday by Penguin, and it was also published in time for the centenary of the publication of Dubliners. And Kevin, you still have your father's copy of the Dubliners.
I do, yeah. It's really, until recently, the only copy of Dubliners that I had. And if you look in the selected bibliography, I actually cite that version of Dubliners, which is a small way of saying hello to my father, because I think, in a way, books are ways to connect people to people.
And I couldn't agree more. And, of course, I have an independent bookstore, so I obviously feel that way as well. So I can't pronounce the – I've never been able to pronounce the publisher of the first editions of Dubliners. Is it Hoopsch, H-U-E-B-S-C-H?
Yeah, Hoopsch. Okay. He ended up founding Viking. So, but before it was called Viking, it was the imprint was under his name.
And we were talking about how much I love Joyce, and that's another one I have the first edition of by Hoopsch is Dubliners, and you know, it's funny, I have a love-hate relationship with having first editions, because you know, once you read the book, you have the author's soul in your mind. It's, the question is, what's the intrinsic value of having a first edition? But that's neither here nor there. We're here to sell your book.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, the first edition of Ulysses was an especially rare find for people. So, you know, there were only 1,000 books published in that first printing of that first edition. It was a limited edition, and it was circulated privately. So to have one of those copies is to be, you know, one of less than 1,000 people, because I don't think all 1,000 survived. In fact, I know not all 1,000 survived. Some of the copies of the first edition were already beginning to be seized by U.S. customs officials as they're being sent out from Paris into the United States.
In addition to that, a lot of the people who did try to bring it over would rip the blue wrappers off, and mine still has the blue wrappers, which is it's the perfect sea green color that Buck Mulligan is talking about when they're at the Martello Tower. It's the perfect color for the covers of the book.
Yeah, and he wanted, Joyce asked the printer to get the blue to match the blue of the Greek flag, and it was incredibly, Joyce was very demanding, it was incredibly difficult for him to match the exact color. The printer actually had to go to Germany from France to get the color. I don't know exactly how they did it. But a lot of the copies that ended up making their way into the United States were bound in fake covers. Some of them were bound as the Holy Bible. Some were bound as the complete works of Shakespeare. One copy that I know of was bound as a biography of Ulysses S. Grant. So all these were basically decoy covers to get Ulysses into the United States, so that when a customs official was going through your belongings to making sure that you weren't taking any contraband into the United States, they would take a quick look at the book and not realize that it's actually James Joyce's Ulysses, which, if they did realize it, would have been taken away immediately.
Well, you know, we'll be talking about obscenity a lot today with regard to the book, because that's essentially what this book pivots on. But one of the things I wanted to mention was, it's such a perfect storm that brings Bennett Cerf and Morris Ernst and Judge Woolsey and then Miss Barry, Miss Weaver, Miss Beach, and of course Nora Barnacle, and
right.
And so it's like the Beatles. Tell a little bit about, I know we'll be going into the trial, the non-jury trial, but tell a little bit, which was fascinating, about how Judge Woolsey ended up being the judge.
So Morris Ernst, who was one of the co-founders of the ACLU, was very keen on getting Ulysses legalized, because he thought it would expand the freedom to publish literature in general. He had a lot of experience defending, quote-unquote obscene books, and in his experience, juries were horrible. that it was always better to have a judge issue a verdict on a book rather than a jury, because juries, as soon as they would sit down with a group of 11 other people, they would suddenly become offended by books that they actually really weren't offended by, because it was this performance of purity. So he was looking for a judge to rule on it, and he wanted the government to waive the right to a jury trial to it, which the government actually did agree to do. And he wanted Judge Woolsey in particular because Woolsey was a well-read man, and he cared about literature, and he had actually ruled on a couple of cases, obscenity cases before, cases that were argued by Morris Ernst. One of them was a pamphlet, medical pamphlet called Contraception by Dr. Marie Snopes, Marie Stopes. And so Woolsey knew that, Ernst knew that Woolsey was a sympathetic person. And so they had to manipulate the judicial calendar, because there's a rotating panel of judges on the Federal District Court. And so they waited effectively for months to get Judge Woolsey assigned to the case. And when he was, then suddenly they realized they had a good shot at getting it legalized. But if it wasn't for Judge Woolsey, if some other judge had considered it, there's a good chance that it would not have been legalized in 1933.
I don't think it would ever have happened. It was, and like I said, it's just so many karmic wheels had to turn at exactly the right time for all of this to occur.
Right. I mean, there was another judge that was supposed to be sitting the time on the date where the hearing was going to be set, and that judge happened to get sick.
Yeah.
And so Woolsey was effectively taking another judge's place. And he read the book cover to cover. A lot of the details that I've gotten about Judge Woolsey, he's a character that's been, you know, flying under the radar of history for a long time. But I managed to track down Judge Woolsey's grandson, and Judge Woolsey's grandson gave me all these private documents to look at. The library where Judge Woolsey read the book is still intact the way it was in 1933 when the judge read the book. And so there are all these little details that make Judge Woolsey alive are still in private hands, and so I was very lucky to get them.
It was great when Bennett Cerf and Random House included, for various reasons, the decision in the book itself, you know, because then if it was challenged again, the decision would be there and it would be established as a classic. But when I read that first, in many ways that was as eloquent and as valuable to me in terms of literature.
Right.
Yeah.
It's really an amazing opinion, because here you have a judge who is effectively engaging literary criticism, which is one of the only times a judge is actually willing to do that and is effectively called upon to do that. But the literary criticism he issues about the book is really really on point and is very sharp.
Yeah, and what's...
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what's even more amazing is when it went up on appeal before Learned Hand and his cousin,
right,
that they upheld it, even though they really didn't like Woolsey's, they didn't...
Yeah, it's one of the things that, you know, I discovered is that, you know, Learned Hand and Judge Woolsey didn't get along very well, and when Woolsey wrote his opinion, one of the unusual things about the opinion is he doesn't cite very much case law. Usually you sort of backstop an opinion with multiple other opinions that are similar, and he could have cited Learned Hand, because Learned Hand had some important decisions related to obscenity, but he didn't. He sort of wrote the opinion with the hope that it would be read by people outside of the law. And now that Random House had decided to print a copy of the decision along with every copy of Ulysses that they've ever published, it's potentially the single most read judicial decision in U.S. history.
Yeah, no doubt. It's amazing that I think if Ulysses was held up to scrutiny now in many courts or in many states where evolution is not able to be taught, it would now be found obscene. In fact, think about it, it's, you know, almost a century now coming up. I can't say the words that Molly Bloom says in her soliloquies.
Right.
I can't say them here on the air.
Right, right. There are still, I mean, some people ask me, you know, what's the importance of this story for us today? And one of the answers to that is that obscenity is as illegal today as it was in 1922 when Ulysses was first published in Paris. The only difference between today and 1922 is in the way that we define obscenity. And that definition of obscenity can change at any time. All it takes is a few new cases by high courts that start to redefine what obscenity means. And part of what's so important about the Woolsey decision is that it was instrumental in changing both our understanding of what obscenity is, and I think even more crucially, and this is what people don't normally get, I think, Woolsey was changing our understanding of what art is. Because for Woolsey, art was something powerful enough to transform what we normally think of as being dirty into something beautiful and useful. For Woolsey, it was like a little piece of a mosaic that could contribute to a larger picture that Joyce is painting about everyday life in the 20th century. And that was actually very new. These days, we think of that as a normal thing to think about. But it used to be that if you had something dirty, if you were saying a few dirty words, it didn't matter what the context was. It was dirty in and of itself, and therefore it could be banned. But Woolsey had transformed that way of thinking about the relationship between art and so-called filth.
And what's really interesting, you have these, I guess you can't call them epigraphs, but you have these introductory quotes to the chapters. And in one of them, where Joyce is so dependent on Nora, when he talks about, you know, now my darling Nora, and he even says that his book is ugly and obscene. He uses the word obscene. And it's just funny because it's what happens is almost that the value of the book, well, it's true, what the value of the book trumps what is clearly actually obscene. I mean, what when people say now everything can be said, like Ezra Pound or Hemingway saying, you know, there's no limits now.
Right.
Some of the things, you know, that Molly says are offensive to me.
Yeah, I mean, they're still disturbing. And you really can see, Nora Barnacle is Joyce's partner, is behind the story and in a way hovers over the story in more ways than one. And one of the ways in which she inspired Joyce and turned him into a writer, effectively, is these so-called dirty letters that they exchanged back and forth between each other in 1909 when Joyce had returned to Ireland for a few months and Nora Barnacle was still in Trieste. And in these letters, Joyce, you know, in 1909... Joyce was still not published. He had, Dubliners had not yet come out yet. In fact, he was struggling to find a publisher for Dubliners, and it wouldn't be, as you've mentioned earlier, until 1914 until he would actually get a publisher. So he was at a crossroads, and he felt as if he was questioning whether or not he could actually be a writer at all. But in these letters, you can find himself really making himself vulnerable to Nora Barnacle by telling her everything he wanted to do to her and with her. And you can see this sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, an obscene imagination sort of taking shape in his mind and the willingness to actually put it down on paper for the first time for him. And it's this great unburdening. And you can see how Joyce is learning how to say everything to someone. And in a way, I think of Joyce thinking of all of his readers as someone like Nora Barnacle, someone who is a lover from afar, who is going to be listening very carefully to every word you say. That's what he wanted. Nora was a model for every reader Joyce ever wanted.
Yeah, and Joyce would have been satisfied with one reader spending his entire life, his or her life, especially with regard to Finnegan's Wake. But what he wanted was, he was a very vain man in terms of his literature, and lots of other things, too, and a very demanding man.
I mean, I think it's definitely true, and I think that, some of the characteristics that made Joyce an incredible writer made him a very difficult person to deal with. He had this strong conviction about the importance of his work, but what that meant is that everything and everyone else in his life took second place. Nora Barnacle was probably the one exception, and he would sort of push her and be demanding with her until, you know, she got upset, and then, of course, he would apologize and depended upon her very much. But it was tough to deal with him because he was so convinced about the importance of his writing, and in a way, he needed that conviction in order to get the writing done in the first place, to spend hours upon hours. There's this one moment where Lucia Joyce's daughter, is remembering Joyce after he died, and she's remembering him writing Ulysses in the middle of World War One. And the image that she calls up in her mind is of her father on the floor, and arrayed all around him are these notes and notebooks and manuscript pages, and they're all crossed out in red and blue and green crayon and so forth. And she's looking at him, and it's this image of him isolating himself, that he had sort of ensconced himself in this novel, and the novel had become this world for him, and the family felt as if they were being pulled into it. And it must have been tough for her and tough for the family to see Joyce retreating the way he did.
When you look at the Rosenberg edition of the facsimile of the actual manuscript, the person I feel most sympathetic for is anybody who attempted to transcribe. I can't even imagine.
The handwriting is incredibly bad. To read the manuscripts or all the letters, and you know there are thousands of letters. Luckily, most of them have been transcribed by other scholars, so I didn't have to go through all of them. But there are several unpublished letters that you know you're trying to read, and it really is tough to do. The only advantage, I should say, is that you do sort of get used to someone's handwriting after a while. After you've read about 8 or 9 letters, it gets a little bit easier. But a lot of people had really difficult handwriting to deal with, including Joyce.
Well, the funny thing is, it's like, you know, you could say, well, wait a minute, Dubliners or Portrait of the Artist could be like the Rosetta Stone, in which you could then interpret what the words were. But the problem is then even worse if you get to Finnegan's Wake, because a good percentage of the words are not words at all.
He must have had troubles. In some cases people were transcribing things for him by the time Finnegan's Wake was happening. But people, typists refused to do the work.
I would have.
Because they were, you know, for Ulysses, he had 9 typists just for one episode, for the Circe episode. They had various problems. Some people just refused to do it. Some people got sick. And then one typist, her husband, looked at what she was typing and burned the manuscript. So a portion of Ulysses was burned in manuscript before it was even published as a book. So the problems began very early and extended long after the Paris publication of Ulysses.
It's interesting. In your introduction, you talk about there's so many biographies of Joyce, and that this wouldn't be a biography. But from time to time, you were required by your research to also include things that were happening in Joyce's life or his history in order to make the rest of the book make sense. And maybe you could talk a little to our audience about these patrons that were all women, whether it's, as I said, Miss Weaver or Sylvia Beach, who was like my heroine, you know?
Right. Yes, she's, you know, Sylvia Beach as, you know, the paragon or the patron saint of independent booksellers, worked really hard for Joyce, as did Harriet Shaw Weaver, who effectively funded Ulysses. The reason why Joyce was able to quit teaching English and write full time is because Harriet Shaw Weaver was giving him money. And She's remarkable for being very prim and proper, and she came from a devout Church of England family in the UK, and her family was taken aback by the fact that she was being a patron for this scandalous writer, this writer that people were calling a literary Bolshevist. They were calling him an anarchist. They were calling him insane. He was just the complete opposite of everyone that... of everything that Harriet Weaver, or Miss Weaver, as everyone called her, the opposite of what she seemed to be. And Sylvia Beach gave everything to Joyce, and Joyce acknowledged this years later, that she effectively devoted the prime years of her life to him and to his book. She opened up Shakespeare and Company in 1919, and she had to borrow money to get her stock, to decorate the place. And it was just tough to make ends meet. So tough, in fact, that she lived in one of the small rooms in the back of her bookshop. She was sleeping on a cot in the back of that bookshop, right next to a metal grate where she could hear the rats sort of crawling along the grate. And that was how she started off. She had very little money. But she met Joyce in 1920, and she was captivated both by him as a person and as a writer. And when the censorship trouble started, because they started before Joyce was even finished with the book, all of the publishers, including Hoebs, who we were talking about earlier, all of the publishers fled. They wanted nothing to do with Ulysses after a portion of it was banned. Joyce came into Shakespeare and Company and sat down in his favorite chair. He had a favorite chair in Shakespeare and Company, and complained about the fact that he couldn't find a publisher, that now no one wanted to publish his book. And finally, after listening to Joyce complaining, Sylvia Beach said to him, "Would you like me to publish your Ulysses?" And Joyce said, "I would." And so that was the small moment that took place in an independent bookshop that changed both their lives and changed the history of modernism forever.
And it's so funny that she was so put upon by him, and your book makes it, it's an interesting, poignant point that finally she says something, but she says it in such a eloquent, polite way. You know, she says, you know, "Look, I've done all this for you, and you please like kind of give me a break," you know?
Yeah, it's as if it's almost as if Joyce wanted to test people's limits for him, and I think he was doing that for Sylvia Beach. There was a part of Joyce that that almost wanted to be betrayed, I think, or to wanted people to turn their backs on him. And that's, I think, what was happening with Sylvia Beach at the time. And finally, he had found Sylvia Beach's breaking point, and she just said, "I can't do this anymore. You're asking for advances to printings of Ulysses that aren't even out yet. It's hard for me just to make ends meet, and here I am running around trying to get eye medication for you and helping your family out and taking care of all your needs and getting books for you and so forth." And it was just, at some point it just became too much. But you can really see, you know, Sylvia Beach is one of the heroes. I don't want to say unsung heroes, because people all know about her, but it's hard to say enough good things about her. When Ernest Hemingway met her when he was young and in Paris, he called her the nicest person he had ever met. And I think a lot of people felt the same way about her.
That's interesting. This is an aside. Many people in our audience may not know about it, but I just wanted to ask you if you had ever met Sylvia Beach Whitman and the new Shakespeare and Company. Have you been there?
I haven't. I was in Paris. The last time I was in Paris was about 10 or 11 years ago, and I was looking for Shakespeare and Company, and I foolishly looked for Shakespeare and Company at the original address. And, of course, today's Shakespeare and Company is really an homage to that original Shakespeare and Company. So I never was able to get to the current Shakespeare and Company. But I do want to go. Hopefully I'll be able to get to Paris over the next year or two. But yes, it is nice to see that the current proprietor is named Sylvia, in honor of Sylvia Beach. And I think it's wonderful, and the devotion that independent booksellers have to books and to connecting books to people is something rare these days, and something that needs to be kept alive.
Yeah, and it's really true of independent bookstores, and it's nice that she bequeathed most of her papers and the photographs of all the authors to Mr. Whitman, who just died not too long ago.
And now, yeah, it's one of the remarkable things, and there's so many pictures of Shakespeare and Company, but what was so wonderful about it is that it felt as if you were walking into someone's home. It didn't feel like it was a store. It wasn't impersonal at all. There were, again, all these pictures that authors themselves were sending to Sylvia Beach, because they wanted to have a little presence in this bookshop. And there was this intimacy in the bookshop that made it a wonderful home away from home for the lost generation. You know, I think of Shakespeare and Company as a place where the lost generation could go to find a home.
And that reminds me, which I had no idea, and knowing he was a great poet and knowing my respect for him just from his being an author, is Ezra Pound was a really cool guy.
Ezra Pound had a lot of sides to him, and one of the sides that comes out in The Most Dangerous Book is his willingness to really do everything he could for writers he believed in. And for Joyce was one of the few writers he really believed in, and he was willing to do anything to help Joyce out. The same was true for T.S. Eliot. The same was true for... He started the careers of several poets, you know. H.D. is one of them. Marianne Moore, he helped out.
And Hemingway.
And Ezra Pound, I sort of think of as this evangelist for these bright young writers, and he had such a great eye for talent, and he was so selfless about it. That's what Hemingway said when he talked about Ezra Pound, that he was righteous and angry like a saint, and he was willing to do anything for you if he saw some talent in you. And Hemingway was one of the people who benefited from that.
One of the great things you talk about is how Hemingway taught him how to box. I can just picture that.
Yeah, I mean, he was. They were both game, and one of the things that Hemingway. Now, if Hemingway finds this remarkable about you, that it must be really true. Hemingway, when he wrote about Ezra Pound, remarked on his intense energy, all this energy that Ezra Pound had, and I mean, Hemingway himself is someone with a lot of energy. But for Ezra Pound, especially in those Paris years, it was this constant sense, this conviction that things needed to be done, that you were on the cusp of greatness. And again, it's that there's a certain charge in the air in Paris at this time that was really inspiring so many people.
It's so funny, you know, when Hemingway says, if he would just eat slower.
Right, I know. Even the way he eats, you can tell the energy is like a volcano.
And the other funny thing is when you look at him in pictures, like everybody else kind of looks dated if you look at Sylvia Beach or if you look at even Joyce. But Ezra Pound looks like he could just hang around with us now, you know? He's got this wild look, but he looks like some kid in college. It's just, you know.
He does, right, because he had this Van Dyke facial hair with a mustache and a very thin pointed beard. He doesn't look dated because he was out of date even at the time. So now, you know, you could see him walking down the streets because in a way he's a little bit like a hipster. I don't mean to insult Ezra Pound, but there's a certain style that he had.
Well, his hair, too. His hair is, like, definitely all
right, Quran. Right, the sort of unkempt hair, and he sort of had the shirts unbuttoned. He had trousers that were made from the felt of a billiard table. So he was eccentric, and he was willing to be eccentric. And it was a time when you weren't self-conscious about being eccentric. If he was, you know, in London, London was a very, you know, somewhat stifling atmosphere for someone like Ezra Pound, which is why he ended up going to Paris. But it almost seemed as if a city like London, which had somewhat staid sensibilities, couldn't contain him.
Yes, I can understand that. And it goes, I just can't keep from thinking about how, if not or but for, none of, it's like when Max Brod promised Kafka that he would burn all of his works, and then Max Brod broke the promise, and therefore we have the trial, we have the castle. And you think, well, should he have broken the promise or not? But if he kept it, we wouldn't have any of those things. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how many famous, wonderful authors never got the opportunity that Joyce got.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that The Most Dangerous Book brings out is that we normally think of a book as a solitary thing, that it's a writer who sits down with pen and paper, or these days with a computer, and write something, and then at the end, there's a book. But the truth, though, is that it takes a large group of people to publish a book. And for Ulysses in particular, it's a really an incredible constellation of characters, of people without whom Ulysses wouldn't exist. And in a lot of cases, it's a bizarre mix of people that you wouldn't expect to go together. We have anarchists and suffragettes who are teaming up with Wall Street lawyers, and you have ACLU lawyers who are teaming up with go-getter publishers who realize that an obscenity case can be great publicity. And so, you know, it starts with Joyce, but it radiates out far beyond him. And I sort of think of The Most Dangerous Book as a sort of snapshot of the way culture was like in the early 20th century and how literary modernism worked through the publication history of one specific book.
Yeah, you don't usually think of smuggling as part of the publication process in, right. in a new Stephen King book. But it is, you know, it's, and the other thing about the book, and you do bring this out, is that whether it's Woolsey or whether it's me, you know, when you start the book, it's, you know, stately plump Buck Mulligan ascend it the staircase, and he's carrying this, and you think, oh, this is like a regular book.
Right.
You know, it's like, this is just going to be a book, and you think of a book, and you talk about this really nicely about, okay, here's a book, here's a story, there's a beginning, there's a middle, and an end, there's these characters that will be developed, there's punctuation, there's quotation marks, and I think that goes a lot to why, obviously why it was difficult for anyone to read the book all the way through, and that's why it's such a, I guess, a monument to the judge that he was able to do so.
Yeah, it was, Judge Woolsey spent about 2 months, I think a little bit over 2 months, actually reading the book, and this was his vacation. He was lucky enough, another sort of coincidence of history or a nice turn of fate for Joyce, is that part of the reason why the judge was able to read Ulysses in the first place is because he had an extended vacation, and the reason why he had this extended vacation is because he had presided over what was the longest trial in U.S. history. So the court system gave him this long vacation, and he spent it reading it. But it's true, he was no more used to seeing a book like this than anyone else was at the time. And one of the things that's startling about Ulysses is that you turn the page to the next chapter, and the next chapter is entirely different. And as soon as you start to get used to the way one chapter is written, you turn to another chapter, and that's all changed. And this is part of what made Ulysses so unsettling to people. And it's hard to think of it now because we're used to people changing styles. But at the time, you know, when T.S. Eliot read it, he said, wow, this is destroying all of the styles. All of the styles of the English language are destroyed. He had reduced them all to futility. And the 19th century has been destroyed, which for T.S. Eliot was wonderful. But you read Ulysses and you can see Joyce really did absorb all these different styles. There's one chapter where he effectively starts with Middle English and goes through the development of the English language up until the present day. And they all get transformed in this new language, and Joyce called it scorching all the styles of the English language, and that was one of the things that people found really disturbing, that it seemed as if tradition itself was being destroyed by Ulysses. It wasn't just the sexuality of the book, which of course was also disturbing, but it was the way in which the tradition of English letters seemed to be cast overboard.
This next question will lead me into a whole other area, which is great because I had these questions written down, but you just led into the area which Virginia Woolf's elitist view of the book and then her essentially conversion that turned it to one of her best literary accomplishments. Maybe you can tell that story.
Yeah, so Virginia Woolf first came in touch with Ulysses when it was being serialized in the Little Review, which was published in New York. And so it wasn't yet finished, and she didn't really like it. And it, you know, kept being serialized, and at some point, Harriet Shaw Weaver asked Virginia Woolf if she would print portions of Ulysses for her magazine, The Egoist, because they couldn't find a printer. The laws at the time stipulated that not only were booksellers and publishers liable for obscenity, but so were printers. So whoever printed the book could potentially go to jail for printing something if it were deemed obscene. She effectively rejected Ulysses. She said that she didn't want to print it. And the ostensible reason, the reason that she gave Harriet Weaver, was that they were too busy, they didn't have enough time. But the truth is that she didn't like Ulysses very much. And Leonard Woolf, her husband, was worried that they would get prosecuted. She asked a few people what they thought about the book, and they told him that he would be legally liable for any charges. So that ended that portion of Ulysses for her. And after 1922, or, you know, in 1921 and 1922, she befriends T.S. Eliot, and T.S. Eliot was raving about Ulysses, and every time he'd come over to dinner, he'd keep talking about Ulysses over and over again. This is a wonderful book. You have to read it. It's incredible. It's almost impossible to write novels anymore after this book. And finally, you know, because she respected T.S. Eliot, she said, okay, I'm going to read it from cover to cover now. And she bought a copy of the book and read it, and she still didn't really like it. She thought that parts of it were good. She thought that it was a little bit of a misfire, as she put it, that there were a lot of little, you know, you were getting little tiny pebbles hitting your face instead of one shotgun blast, right, as she described it in her diaries. But there was something about Ulysses that worked really slowly on the minds of people. And this happened for Virginia Woolf as well, where she didn't like it, but she ended up thinking about it. And as the weeks and months went by, she thought about it more and more. And she started to get inspired by the idea, by the largeness of the idea, and by the fact that it was a book that didn't have to deal with only beautiful things, that it dealt with unpleasant things, and that it was so close to the characters that it described. So eventually, Virginia Woolf ended up writing Mrs. Dalloway, which is, to some degree, her version of Ulysses. It's told in one day in London instead of Dublin, and it follows the consciousnesses of three separate characters. And at the time, it was her most ambitious book, and it owes quite a bit to her reading of James Joyce.
It's so fascinating when you're dealing with Mrs. Dalloway and Ulysses, because as a reader, it's very difficult to understand and to read while you realize that you're examining an entire life, inside and outside. And so, like right now, as I'm thinking, well, how much time do I have left to talk here? And you're maybe thinking, well, what's my next interview or whatever. Mm-hmm. The most poignant moment in the book for me was during the arguments, when I guess Ernst says, you know, right now I'm thinking, I'm thinking of how your robe doesn't fit well.
Right.
This and then you know he knows he's got him then, because Wolsey said, and I'm looking back at the chair and thinking, I wonder, and you realize this is what people do all the time. They never
right.
stop doing it, and.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that was the real insight at the trial, and it was what Woolsey ended up talking about in his decision. We think of consciousness as a stream, and this metaphor comes from William James, and I think it's useful, but it's also misleading because it's not exactly like a stream. That sort of suggests this singular flow of a set of words that can be strung one after the other on a page. For Joyce and for Judge Woolsey and for Morris Ernst at the trial, it was really more multiple images or ideas overlaying one another, so that we have one particular thing that's the focus of our attention, but whenever we're focusing, we're always also thinking about other things. And what part of why Ulysses can be difficult at times is because it pays attention to the fact that there are multiple things happening in our mind at once. Even when we're thinking over a specific problem, or when we're remembering something, or when we're at work at something in our day-to-day lives, we are inundated with these tiny things in our lives, whether it's a sort of a glass on the table, or it's a memory that we had from a long time ago, or a hope for something to happen tomorrow. And it's this multidimensionality of any given second of our lives that's important, and that shows the complexity of who we are as people. You can't read Ulysses without thinking about the way you think. And that's one of the things that I think happened to people when they were reconsidering the book. You know, when Virginia Woolf starts to realize that she can be aware of her own thoughts, and they're not exactly the way you think they're going to be. It's not this fluid, easy stream. It's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah, it's you can almost think, I mean, if you're placing an advertisement like Leopold is, and you have all the, I mean, it's not that they're mentally ill people, but you can almost see it that way. But I know there's times in my own life, many times, where I'm doing something very plebeian, very something work a day, And yet the thing I'm thinking about behind that is much more important, whether you're thinking of a memory that gives rise to regret or guilt, or whether you're thinking back to a happy Christmas morning. Your mind does that to you. And the only way you can avoid that is if you live in the moment. And that's so hard to do.
I mean, it's, you know, I think our minds are not particularly good at giving proportional time and attention to the things that are proportionally important. You'd think that we would think most about the things that are most important and least about the things that aren't. But for some reason, our minds don't really work that way. And Joyce was an artist. You know, one of the ways we think of Joyce and what makes him distinctive as an artist is that we think of him as an artist of epiphanies, right? And what defines the Joycean epiphany is that it can come from something very small. It can come from looking up at a cloud and seeing, you know, Stephen and Leopold actually see the same cloud in the morning in Dublin. They're different parts of the city, but it's a little tiny thing that connects them. Or, you know, the way a bracelet falls on someone's wrist, or the way someone tears apart a pastry. These little tiny things in life, things that we normally overlook, can end up having an outsized effect, and we can sort of have large insights into things from them. And that's what it means to talk about a Joycean epiphany, and it's part of what distinguishes Joyce's writing from the writing of so many others.
Yeah, when I had my seminar in college, we talked about the idea of the gnomon, the idea of a part of something being this tiny part of a greater whole. And I remember when I was 18 years old in college, I remember it was in Florida, and I found a chameleon on a tree, and I picked it up, and it opened its mouth, and a spider came out. And so I was 18, and all these years later, why? I mean, it didn't mean anything, but it meant everything.
It's such a, I mean, and that image in particular is such a vivid image. I can easily understand how you would never forget that, right? But think of some of the things that you know, remember are silly things, like, you know, pointless things. Why do I remember them? I have no idea, you know, why I do, but they stick with us. And, you know, for Joyce, he wanted to tell the history of this city and the history of the lives of these people through the story of one day. And it's true that this idea of the part containing the whole is what's behind Ulysses. That if you could really tell everything about just one day, say everything about it, you would know about so much more than that one day.
Yeah, when I graduated law school, my mother gave me a pocket watch, and I asked her to inscribe it with "In omnibus partibus reluca totum," which means in each particle, the whole repeats itself. Yes. And if you ever really think about it like you just articulated, and you actually believe it, it does change your entire view of the universe.
Yeah, it's sort of like I describe it in my book as sort of like a fractal of Western civilization, where, like, you know, you can see the part is just a small version of the whole. And that's what, you know, the whole project of Ulysses is basically saying, look, what can happen on this one day is not fundamentally different from this the Odyssey, right? This epic that took place, or didn't really take place, but this epic written thousands of years ago. And to see our own normal, maybe boring lives as versions of these heroic lives was fascinating to Joyce, and it's something that he wanted to experiment with. So for Joyce, history wasn't linear, it wasn't a line going forward, it was cyclical, and we're part of this cycle. And, you know, our great-grandchildren will repeat our stories, and we're repeating the stories of our great-grandparents.
Yes, it's funny, too, and you do have some time to get into Finnegan's Wake a little bit in your book, just because, and we can talk about Joyce's physical pain, too, but the thing about it is that you have this one book that's about a day in the life of essentially three people. And then you have Finnegan's Wake, which breaks through other barriers, which is that it isn't really a novel of any kind. And it's a history, not a history, it's a retelling of dreams, but all the dreams. And that's why with my little daughter, we used to sit up at night and read Finnegan's Wake, because she was
like, "Wow, you must have some daughter. That's incredible."
No, but think about it. Is it really? Because she could read it fine, but it doesn't make any difference because she couldn't understand it, and I couldn't understand it. I think the only thing you can do with Finnegan's Wake is to open at any page, read it aloud with an Irish accent.
Yeah, right. You know, I think that's true. The you know, your daughter or children in general, I think, are more tuned to the musicality of language than we are, and they're more comfortable with not knowing the meanings of words than we are. And that's, I sometimes wonder if people would be less upset with Finnegan's Wake if we stopped calling it a novel and we thought of it as a prose poem or something like that, where, you know, the expectations of a novel are just not there. They're not fulfilled by a book like Finnegan's Wake. But I also tell people, look, if you've, so many people say to me, you know, Kevin, I've never read Ulysses, but after reading your book, I'm thinking of giving it a try. That's one of the best compliments I think I can get. But they're still nervous about actually doing it. And I'll say, well, look, read the first 10 pages of Finnegan's Wake, and then go back to Ulysses, and you'll find that Ulysses is much easier. So if you want Ulysses to seem easy by comparison, Finnegan's Wake is your book.
Well, you also kind of tricked them, too, because you got to get out of the Martello Tower. I mean,
that's true. I do warn them that the third episode is the most difficult one, and I think that's where most people stop. They don't. They figure that the book is going to get progressively more difficult, and that's not really what happens at all. It sort of undulates back and forth. But if you can get past the third episode, you're in really good shape.
And one of the things you say is kind of comforting to people is, you know, you don't really have to understand it while you're reading it, you know? You don't have to.
Yeah, and I think that's what happens. There's an episode called Sirens, and it begins with this overture. And I actually heard a reading of it yesterday for Bloomsday. Someone did a reading of that, of the overture for Sirens. And it doesn't really make any sense. It's sort of a dry run, I think, for Finnegan's Wake. It doesn't make sense when you're initially reading it, but it does make sense in retrospect, because what happens is that it's basically a whole range of sounds that end up getting inserted into different parts of the book, and suddenly you realize, oh, okay, this is the sound of coins in Blazes Boylan's pocket, or the sound of hooves going down the street because the viceroy is in town and there's a little parade. So, but the episode itself is written in the style of music. That's why it's the Sirens episode, and it's inspired by music. And in order to write an episode that is musical, you have to make the sounds of words more important than the meanings of words. And so that's one way to do it, is to make the words not technically dictionary words.
The thing that comes to mind almost every time I start talking about this is, how the hell did he do it? You know? It's like, how the hell was he able to do this? It's almost impossible to believe.
How did he write Ulysses?
I mean, when I read Portrait of the Artist, I identified with it. I was at prep school at the time. I didn't like being there. When he writes in the inside of his book, James Joyce, Dublin, Ireland, the world, whatever, I did that too. And and then reading Dubliners was slightly more difficult, but you could, in fact, you know, they're doing Dubliners at 100. You've read about that?
Yes.
That's going to be really cool, except I can't imagine anyone doing The Dead, but I guess they're going to find someone to do it. So when you read Portrait of the Artist and you read Dubliners, you think, well, yeah, this is really good, and I'm ready to dive into this new one he has. And then you're just like, it's like someone's cut your legs off.
Yeah, it is strange, you know, the magic that goes on in, you know, an artist's mind that turns a small project into a massive project. And Ulysses was initially meant to be a short story in Dubliners. It wasn't supposed to be very long. It was just supposed to be a few pages. But something somehow happens, and some unforeseeable growth took place in his mind, and it became larger and larger, and he realized, no, this is a novel. But to think of Ulysses as just a story in Dubliners is such a radically different thing. But the inspiration took hold, and it was hard work. One of the things that you know, you ask, you know, how did Joyce end up doing it. How did he sort of achieve this? It's partly stubbornness. He was he had this dogged sense of a mission, right? That he was sort of meant to do something like this, and that it was worthwhile. And I think if you believe that what you're doing is worthwhile, the way James Joyce did, you're willing to endure, you know, all the hardship and travails that go along with trying to make your endeavors happen.
As we're getting ready to wind up, why don't we? This is one thing you need to tell the audience, I think, to understand the entire process. And this is where you go into the biography, because you have to, is tell, you know, I guess, the backdrop of the pain and suffering that James Joyce went through, and the genesis of that pain and suffering with regard to his vision and other physical problems.
Yeah. So, well, one of the things that's gotten a lot of attention about the book so far is my discovery of a medication that Joyce was given in 1928. Joyce had very severe eye problems, starting at the very least in 1907 and really lasting through his entire life. He was effectively blind by the time he was finishing Finnegan's Wake. And it's one of the problems is that none of the biographers, that, you know, there are about 8 biographies of Joyce, no one actually explains why he was getting these eye problems. One of the things I discovered is that in 1928, James Joyce was given 3 weeks of injections of arsenic and phosphorus. And this medication is actually an anti-syphilitic drug called Galil, G-A-L-Y-L. And effectively, by far the most common reason why someone would have these eye problems, these infections of your irises or swelling of the irises, is because of syphilis. So Joyce had had symptoms that could almost only be explained by syphilis, and his doctor, a doctor that he'd had for years, was treating him for syphilis. So I think the only reasonable conclusion is that James Joyce had syphilis, and so it was something that he was suffering privately from for quite a long time. And really affected his life in powerful ways. If you know, if you want to think about you know, epiphanies and how important changes can come from small things, that's one example of it. I mean, I think what syphilis did was that it intensified what he already felt about life. I mean, imagine having a sharp pain on the inside of your eye, and that pain might go away. It might go away for weeks or months, but it'll suddenly recur out of nowhere. You could be walking down the street, you could be brushing your teeth, grocery shopping, and suddenly the pain will return. And at some point, your doctor is going to tell you that you have to get eye surgery for it, that the only way to reduce the pressure that's building up inside of your eye is to cut away a small piece of your iris. And Joyce had undergone about 12 of these eye surgeries over the course of his life. So this is a part of his day-to-day life, the fear of pain, the experience of pain, the anticipation of future pain, and going blind slowly. And ultimately, this was being caused by a tiny microscopic spirochete that had invaded his eyes. So you have the tiniest of things, that this tiny unseeable thing is transforming his life, and I think there's something Joycean about that.
Yeah, it's and I'm definitely running out of time, and I have one more question, but yeah, that one scene you talk about when Miss Weaver first sees him, and I think it's Miss Weaver, and she sees his eye and is dead.
Yes.
And also when Hemingway writes that letter saying, "Hey, my daughter just nicked my eye. I just have an idea of what you must be going through."
And yeah, this like really incredible pain. It's hard to imagine it. I sort of had to force myself to imagine it. And some people think, "Oh, this is, I can't believe you're writing about this." But the truth is that, you know, Joyce is an artist of day-to-day experience, and we can't fully understand Joyce's life unless we're willing to look at what his actual experience was like. And when Sylvia Beach first saw James Joyce, he didn't have a pupil. There was no pupil in his eye, and the reason why is because the inflammation in his iris had produced this sort of pus was sort of developing inside of his eye, and sort of blood and biotic material gets floating around. It ends up congealing, and when it congeals, it will actually cover the pupil. So the space where the light is supposed to shine through and get to your retina, it actually can't penetrate anymore, and you don't have a pupil anymore. It's just this grayish haze of of an eye.
You describe it.
That's what he looked like, and that's some of you've seen. Everyone is familiar with pictures of Joyce wearing an eye patch. He was often wearing those eye patches because he was recovering from surgery, but every now and then he was wearing an eye patch because he had a nebula covering his pupil.
And you make it sound really yucky, too.
Yeah, the truth is that it's not pretty. There's no polite and easy way to talk about serious eye problems and eye surgeries. It's just difficult no matter what.
Okay, let me ask you this one last question. Then next time you come, it will be after you've written your book about Finnegan's Wake, which you'll be like.
I hope you'll help me with that. I'm not sure I'm prepared.
You'll be like 20 years older.
Well, maybe your daughter can help.
Yeah, I'll tell her you said so. So the last question was, I have an independent bookstore, so even though I can say 1,000 times you can't judge a book by its cover, but everyone does, and your cover is, reminiscent of another cover. So talk about that within the next 30 seconds or so.
Yeah, so the cover of The Most Dangerous Book is an homage to the first legal edition of Ulysses that was published by Random House in 1934. And it's a beautiful book. It was designed by Ernst Reichel, and he designed both the outside and the inside so that it would be, in a way, in itself a work of art, this modernist work of art. And the typography is beautiful. The first letter of the book, that's S for Stately Plump Buck Mulligan, has a page all to itself, massive S. And the object of Ulysses as just a physical book, was such an important thing to people who were reading it. And I'm really happy that the Penguin Press was able to sort of invoke this physical presence for the book because it's so important.
Yeah, I think it really makes a difference in terms of people wanting to, and especially aficionados seeing this and going, oh, I have to have this book.
Yeah.
Well, in any case, I'm definitely out of time. They're going to kill me. But obviously, it's like you were talking about reading groups. We could definitely go on and on forever about this.
Right.
But thank you so much, Kevin, for being here. It was really enjoyable talking to you, and it's a great book. And
thank you so much.
Okay. Kevin Birmingham discussing In the Most Dangerous Book, which is about Ulysses, and it is one of my favorite books. I took a seminar, be vain enough to say an honors seminar in college on it, and it just changed my life, and then the book changed my life, and Portrait of the Artist, and Dubliners, and I can honestly say that I have no idea what Finnegan's Wake means. I like reading it, but I read it at night by myself, aloud, like I said, in an Irish accent. I think that's the only way you can get through any of it. It's a very musical book. But after you read this book, I think, as Kevin said, I think you can give Ulysses a try. Just keep with it. It's well worth the effort. In any event, next week we got tons of them. The question is, who are we going to get to interview? And unfortunately, for one of the few times, I don't actually know who it's going to be. But you can be assured that it'll be somebody interesting and somebody who's written a novel that will, affect you and me. I try to search for those that I like, which I hope are the same ones that you might like as well. So thanks, as always, for joining us here on The Avid Reader. We will talk to you next week.
You've been listening to The Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.